He merely touched base at his hotel, where he stuffed the pockets of his coat with a sheaf of foolscap, a fountain pen, a silver box loaded with cigars like rounds in an ammo clip, and some tiny containers of nano-snuff that he could use to adjust the functioning of his brain and body. He also hefted a heavy walking stick, a real wizard staff loaded with security aerostats that would shepherd him back to the hotel in the event of a riot. Then he returned once more to the streets, shouldering for a mile through the crowd until he reached a tea house where he had passed many long nights during his tenure at the Parnasse. Old Mrs. Kwan welcomed him warmly, bowing many times, and showing him to his favorite corner table where he could look out on the intersection of Nanjing Road and a narrow side street jammed with tiny market stalls. All he could see now were the backs and buttocks of people in the street, jammed up against the glass by the pressure of the crowd. He ordered a big pot of his favorite green tea, the most expensive kind, picked in April when the leaves were tender and young, and spread out his sheets of foolscap across the table. This tea-house was fully integrated into the worldwide media network, and so the pages automatically jacked themselves in. Under Carl Hollywood's murmured commands, they began to fill themselves with columns of animated text and windows bearing images and cine-feeds. He took his first sip of tea, always the best one, withdrew his big fountain pen from his pocket, removed the lid, and touched it to the paper. He began to inscribe commands onto the page in words and drawings. As he finished the words, they were enacted before him, and as he drew the lines between the boxes and circles, links were made and information flowed. At the bottom of the page, he wrote the word Miranda and drew a circle around it. It was not connected to anything else in the diagram yet. He hoped that before long it would be. Carl Hollywood worked on his papers late into the night, and Mrs. Kwan continued to replenish his teapot and to bring him little sweets and decorated the edge of his table with candles as night fell and the tea-house darkened, for she remembered that he liked to work by candlelight. The Chinese people outside, separated from him by half an inch of cross-linked diamond, watched with their noses making white ellipses against the pane, their faces glowing in the candlelight like ripe peaches hanging in dark, lush foliage. The Hackworths in transit and in London. The East End. A remarkable boat ride. Dramatis personae. A night at the theater. Smooth, fine-grained Arctic clouds undulated slowly like snowdrifts into the distance, 1,000 miles looking like the width of a front yard, lit but not warmed by a low apricot sun that never quite went down. Fiona lay on her stomach on the top bunk, looking out the window, watching her breath condense on the pane and then evaporate in the parched air. "Father," she said, very softly, to see if he was awake. He wasn't, but he woke up quickly, as if he'd been in one of those dreams that just skims beneath the surface of consciousness like an airship clipping a few cloud tops.
"Yes?"
"Who is the alchemist? Why are you looking for him?"
"I would rather not explain why I'm looking for him. Let us say that I have incurred obligations that want settling."
Her father seemed more preoccupied with the second part of the question than she'd expected, and his voice was steeped in regret. "Who is he?" she insisted gently.
"Oh, well, my darling, if I knew that, I'd have found him."
"Father!"
"What sort of person is he? I haven't been afforded many clues, unfortunately. I've tried to draw some deductions from the sorts of people who are looking for him, and the sort of person I am."
"Pardon me, father, but what bearing does your own nature have on that of the alchemist?"
"More than one knowledgeable sort has arrived at the conclusion that I'm just the right man to find this fellow, even though I know nothing of criminals and espionage and so forth. I'm just a nanotechnological engineer."
"That's not true, father. You're ever so much more than that. You know so many stories. You told me so many when you were gone, remember?"
"I suppose so," he allowed, strangely diffident.
"And I read it every night. And though the stories were about fairies and pirates and djinns and such, I could always sense that you were behind them, like the puppeteer pulling the strings and imbuing them with voices and personalities. So I think you're more than an engineer. It's just that you need a magic book to bring it out."
"Well, that's a point I had not considered," her father said, his voice suddenly emotional. She fought the temptation to peer over the edge of the bed and look at his face, which would have embarrassed him. Instead, she curled up in her bed and closed her eyes.
"Whatever you may think of me, Fiona, and I must say I am pleasantly surprised that you think of me so favorably, to those who dispatched me on this errand, I am an engineer. Without being arrogant, I might add that I have advanced rapidly in that field and attained a position of not inconsiderable responsibility. As this is the only characteristic that distinguishes me from other men, it can be the only reason I was chosen to find the alchemist. From this, I infer that the alchemist is himself a nanotechnological researcher of some sophistication, and that he is thought to be developing a product that is of interest to more than one of the powers.
Are you talking about the seed, Father?
He was silent for a few minutes. When he spoke again, his voice was high and tight.
The seed? How did you know about the seed?
You told me about it, Father. You told me it was a dangerous thing, and that protocol enforcement mustn't allow it to be created. And besides...
Besides what?
She was on the verge of reminding him that her dreams had been filled with seeds for the last several years, and that every story she had seen in her primer had been replete with them. Seeds that grew up into castles, dragon's teeth that grew up into soldiers, seeds that sprouted into giant beanstalks leading to alternate universes in the clouds, and seeds given to hospitable, barren couples by itinerant crones that grew up into plants with bulging pods that contained happy, kicking babies. But she sensed that if she mentioned this directly, he would slam the steel door in her face, a door that was tantalizingly cracked open at the moment.
"Why do you think the seeds are so interesting?" she essayed.
"They are interesting inasmuch as a beaker of nitroglycerin is interesting," he said. "They are subversive technology. You are not to speak of the seeds again, Fiona. Kryptnet agents could be anywhere listening to our conversation."
Fiona sighed. When her father spoke freely, she could sense the man who had told her the stories. When certain subjects were broached, he drew down his veil and became just another Victorian gentleman. It was irksome. But she could sense how the same characteristic in a man who was not her father could be provocative. It was such an obvious weakness that neither she nor any woman could resist the temptation to exploit it. A mischievous and hence tantalizing notion that was to occupy much of Fiona's thinking for the next few days as they encountered other members of their tribe in London. After a simple dinner of beer and pasties in a pub on the fringes of the city, they rode south across the Tower Bridge, pierced a shallow layer of posh development along the right bank of the river, and entered into Southwark. As in other Atlantan districts of London, feed lines had been worked into the sinews of the place, coursing through utility tunnels, clinging to the clammy undersides of bridges, and sneaking into buildings through small holes bored into the foundations. The tiny old houses and flats of this once impoverished quarter had mostly been refurbished into toeholds for young Atlantans from all around the Anglosphere, poor in equity but rich in expectations, who had come to the great city to incubate their careers. The businesses on the ground floors tended to be pubs, coffee houses, and music halls. As father and daughter worked their way east, generally paralleling the river, the luster that was so evident near the approaches to the bridge began to wear thin in places, and the ancient character of the neighborhood began to assert itself, as the bones of the knuckles revealed their shape beneath the stretched skin of a fist. Wide gaps developed between the waterfront developments, allowing them to look across the river into a district whose blanket of evening fog was already stained with the carcinogenic, candy-colored hues of big mediatrons. Fiona Hackworth noticed a glow in the air, which resolved into a constellation when she blinked and focused. A pinprick of green light, an infinitesimal chip of emerald, touched the surface of her eye, expanding into a cloud of light. She blinked twice, and it was gone. Sooner or later, it and many others would make their way to the corners of her eyes, giving her a grotesque appearance. She drew a handkerchief from her sleeve and wiped her eyes. The presence of so many lidar-emitting mites prompted her to realize that they had been infiltrating a great expanse of fog for some minutes without really being aware of it. Moisture from the river was condensing around the microscopic guardians of the border. Colored light flashed vaguely across the screen of fog before them, silhouetting a stone column planted in the center of the road. Wings of a griffin, horn of a unicorn,
crisp and black against a lurid cosmos. A constable stood beside the pediment, symbolically guarding the bar. He nodded to the Hackworths and mumbled something gruff but polite through his chin-strap as father and daughter rode out of New Atlantis and into a gaudy clave full of loutish theets scrumming and chanting before the entrances of pubs. Fiona caught sight of an old Union Jack, then did a double-take and realized that the limbs of the St. Andrew's cross had been enhanced with stars, like the Confederate battle flag. She gave her chevaline a nudge and pulled up nearly abreast with her father. Then the city became darker and quieter, though no less crowded, and for a few blocks they saw only dark-haired men with mustaches and women who were nothing more than columns of black fabric. Then Fiona smelled anise and garlic, and they passed into Vietnamese territory for a short time. She would have enjoyed stopping at one of the sidewalk cafes for a bowl of pho, but her father rode on, pursuing the tide that was ebbing down the Thames, and in a few more minutes they had come once again to the bank. It was lined with ancient masonry warehouses, a category of structure now so obsolete as to defy explanation, which had been converted into offices. A pier rode on the surface of the river, riding up and down on the tide, linked to the rim of the granite embankment by a hinged gangway. A shaggy black vessel was tied up to the pier, but it was completely unlit, visible only by its black shadow against the charcoal-gray water. After the Chevalines had planted themselves and the Hackworths had dismounted, they were able to hear low voices coming from below. John Hackworth withdrew some tickets from his breast pocket and asked them to illuminate themselves. But they were printed on old-fashioned paper that did not contain its own energy source, and so he finally had to use the microtorch dangling from his watch chain. Apparently satisfied that they had arrived at the right place, he offered Fiona his arm and escorted her down the gangway to the pier. A tiny flickering light bobbed toward them and resolved into an Afro-Caribbean man, wearing rimless glasses and carrying an antique hurricane lamp. Fiona watched his face as his enormous eyes, yellowed like antique ivory billiard balls, scanned their tickets. His skin was rich and warm and glowing in the light of the candle, and he smelled faintly of citrus combined with something darker and less ingratiating. When he was finished, he looked up, not at the Hackworths, but off into the distance, turned his back, and ambled away. John Hackworth stood there for a few moments, awaiting instructions, then straightened, squared his shoulders, and led Fiona across the pier to the boat. It was 8 or 10 meters long. There was no gangway, and persons already on board had to reach out and clutch their arms and pull them in, a breach of formality that happened so quickly that they had no time to become uncomfortable. The boat was basically a large, flat, open tub, not much more than a life raft, with some controls in the bow and some sort of modern and hence negligibly small propulsion system built into the stern. As their eyes adjusted to the dim light scattering through the fog, they could see perhaps a dozen other passengers around the edge of the boat, seated so that wakes from passing vessels would not upset them. Seeing wisdom in this, John led Fiona to the only remaining open space, and they sat down between two other groups, a trio of young Nipponese men forcing cigarettes on one another, and a man and woman in bohemian but expensive clothes, sipping lager from cans and conversing in Canadian accents. The man from the pier cast off the painters and vaulted aboard. Another functionary had taken the controls and gently accelerated into the current, cutting the throttle at one point and swinging her about into an oncoming wake. When the boat entered the main channel and came up to speed, it very quickly became chilly, and all the passengers murmured, demanding more warmth from their thermogenic clothing. The Afro-Caribbean man made a circuit, lugging a heavy chest stocked with cans of lager and splits of Pinot Noir. Conversation stopped for several minutes as the passengers, all driven by the same primal impulses, turned their faces into the cool wind and relaxed into the gentle thumping of hull against waves. The trip took the better part of an hour. After several minutes, conversation resumed, most of the passengers remaining within their little groups. The refreshment chest made a few more circuits. John Hackworth began to realize, from a few subtleties, that one of the Nipponese youths was much more intoxicated than he was letting on, and had probably spent a few hours in a dockside pub before reaching the pier. He took a drink from the chest every time it came by, and half an hour into the ride, he rose unsteadily to his feet, leaned over the edge, and threw up. John turned to smirk at his daughter.
The boat struck an unseen wave, rolling sideways into the trough. Hackworth clutched first at the railing and then at his daughter's arm. Fiona screamed. She was staring over John's shoulder at the Nipponese youths. John turned around to see that there were only two of them now. The sick one was gone, and the other two had flung their bellies across the gunwale and stretched out their arms, fingers like white rays shining into the black water. John felt Fiona's arm pull free from his grasp, and as he turned toward her, he just saw her vaulting over the rail. It was over before he had an opportunity to get really scared. The crew dealt with the matter with a practiced efficiency that suggested to Hackworth that the Nipponese man was really an actor, the entire incident part of the production. The Afro-Caribbean man cursed and shouted for them to hang on, his voice pure and powerful as a Stradivarius cello, a stage voice. He inverted the cooler, dumping out all the beer and wine, and snapped it shut and flung it over the stern as a life preserver. Meanwhile, the pilot was swinging the boat round. Several passengers, including Hackworth, had turned on micro-torches and focused their beams on Fiona, whose skirts had inflated as she jumped in feet first and now surrounded her like a raft of flowers. With one hand she was clutching the Nipponese man's collar, and with the other the handle of the ice chest. She did not have the strength or buoyancy to hold the drunken man out of the water, and so both of them were swamped by the estuary's rolling waves. The man with the dreadlocks hauled Fiona out first and handed her off to her father. The fabricules making up her clothing, countless mites linked elbow to elbow in a two-dimensional array, went to work pumping away the water trapped in the interstices. Fiona was wreathed in a sinuous veil of mist that burned with the captured light of the torches. Her thick red hair had been freed from the confines of her hat, which had been torn away by the waves, and now fell about her in a cape of fire. She was looking defiantly at Hackworth, whose adrenal glands had finally jumped into the endocrinological fray. When he saw his daughter in this way, it felt as though someone were inexorably sliding a 100-pound block of ice up the length of his spine. When the sensation reached his medulla, he staggered and nearly had to sit down. She had somehow flung herself through an unknown and unmarked barrier and become supernatural, a naiad rising from the waves, cloaked in fire and steam. In some rational compartment of his mind that had now become irrelevant, Hackworth wondered whether Dramatis Personae, for this was the name of the troupe that was running this show, had got some nanocytes into his system, and if so, what exactly they were doing to his mind. Water streamed from Fiona's skirts and ran between the floorboards, and then she was dry, except for her face and hair. She wiped her face on her sleeves, ignoring her father's proffered handkerchief. No words passed between them, and they did not embrace, as if Fiona were conscious now of the impact she was having upon her father and all of the others, a faculty that, Hackworth supposed, must be highly acute in 16-year-old girls. By now, the Nipponese man was just about finished coughing water out of his lungs and gasping piteously for air. As soon as he had the airways up and running, he spoke hoarsely and lengthily. One of his companions translated. "He says that we are not alone, that the water is filled with spirits, that they spoke to him. He followed them beneath the waves, but feeling his spirit about to leave his body, he felt fear and swam to the surface and was saved by the young woman. He says that the spirits are talking to all of us, and we must listen to them." This was, needless to say, embarrassing, and so all of the passengers doused their torches and turned their backs on the stricken passenger. But when Hackworth's eyes had adjusted, he took another look at this man and saw that the exposed portions of his flesh had begun to radiate colored light. He looked at Fiona and saw that a band of white light encircled her head like a tiara, bright enough that it shone red through her hair, with the jewel centered upon her forehead. Hackworth marveled at this sight from a distance, knowing that she wanted to be free of him for now. Fat lights hung low above the water, describing the envelopes of great ships, sliding past each other as their parallax shifted with the steady progress of the boat.
They had come to a place near the mouth of the estuary, but not on the usual shipping lanes, where ships lay at anchor awaiting shifts in tides, winds, or markets. One constellation of lights did not move, but only grew larger as they drew toward it. Experimenting with shadows and examining the pattern of light cast upon the water from this vessel, Hackworth concluded that the lights were being deliberately shone into their faces so that they could not make any judgments about the nature of the source. The fog slowly congealed into a wall of rust, so vast and featureless that it might have been 10 or 100 feet distant. The helmsman waited until they were about to ram it, then cut the engines. The raft lost speed instantly and nuzzled the hull of the big ship. Chains, slimy and dripping, descended from the firmament, diverging in Hackworth's view like radiance emanating from some heavy industrial demigod, clanking harbingers of iron that the crew, heads thrown back ecstatically, throats bare to this kinky revelation, received into their bosoms. They snapped the chains onto metal loops fixed into the floor of the boat. Shackled, the boat rose free of the water and began to ascend the wall of rust, which soared vaguely into the infinite fog. Suddenly there was a railing, an open deck beyond it, pools of light here and there, a few red cigar coals reciprocating through space. The deck swung under and rose to shove at the hull of the little boat. As they disembarked, they could see similar boats scattered about. Dodgy did not begin to describe the reputation of dramatis personae in the New Atlantan parts of London, but that was the adjective they always used anyway, delivered in a near whisper, with brows raised nearly into the hairline and eyes glancing significantly over the shoulder. It had quickly become clear to Hackworth that a man could get a bad reputation simply for having known that dramatis personae existed. At the same time, it was clear that almost everyone had heard about it. Rather than being spattered with any more opprobrium, he had sought the tickets among other tribes. After all this, it did not surprise him in the least to see that most of the attendees were fellow Victorians, and not just young bachelors having a night out, but ostensibly respectable couples, strolling the decks in their top hats and veils. Fiona vaulted out of the boat before it even touched the deck of the ship, and vanished. She had repatterned her dress, ditching the chintzy flowered pattern for basic white, and skipped off into the darkness, her integral tiara glowing like a halo. Hackworth took a slow turn around the deck, watching his fellow tribesmen trying to solve the following problem. Get close enough to another couple to recognize them, without getting so close that they could recognize you. From time to time, couples recognized each other simultaneously and had to say something. The women tittered wickedly, and the men laughed from their bellies and called each other scoundrels, the words glancing off the deck plates and burying themselves in the fog like arrows fired into a bale of cotton. Some kind of amplified music emanated from compartments below. Atonal power chords came up through the deck like seismic disturbances. She was a bulk cargo carrier, now empty and bobbing, surprisingly jittery for something so big. Hackworth was alone and separate from all humanity, a feeling he had grown up with, like a childhood friend living next door. He had found Gwen by some miracle and lost touch with that old friend for a few years, but now he and Solitude were back together, out for a stroll, familiar and comfortable. A makeshift bar amidships had drawn a dozen or so congregants, but Hackworth knew that he could not join in with them. He had been born without the ability to blend and socialize, as some are born without hands.
"Standing above it all," said a voice, "or standing aside, perhaps."
It was a man in a clown outfit. Hackworth recognized it, vaguely, as an advertising fetish for an old American fast food chain. But the costume was conspicuously ill-used, as if it were the sole garment of a refugee. It had been patched all over with swatches of chintz, Chinese silk, studded black leather, charcoal gray pinstripe, and jungle camo. The clown wore integral makeup. His face glowed like an injection-molded plastic toy from the previous century, with a light bulb stuck inside the head. It was disturbing to see him talk, like watching one of those animated CAT scans of a man swallowing.
"Are you of it, or just in it?" the clown said, and looked at Hackworth expectantly.
As soon as Hackworth had realized, quite some time ago, that this dramatis personae thing was going to be some kind of participatory theater, he had been dreading this moment. His first cue.
"Please excuse me," he said in a tense and not altogether steady voice. "This is not my milieu."
"That's for damn fucking sure," said the clown. "Put these on," he continued, taking something out of his pocket.
He reached out to Hackworth, who was 2 or 3 meters away from him, but shockingly, his hand detached itself from his arm and flew through the air, the smutty white glove like a dirty ball of ice, tumbling elliptically through the inner planets. It shoved something into Hackworth's breast pocket and then withdrew. But because Hackworth was watching, it described a smooth, sudden figure-eight pattern in space before reattaching itself to the stump of the forearm. Hackworth realized that the clown was mechanical.
"Put 'em on and be yourself, Mr. Alienated Loner Steppenwolf Bemused Distant Meta-Izing Technocrat Rationalist Fucking Shithead."
The clown spun on his heel to leave. His floppy clown shoes were built around some kind of trick heel with a swivel built in, so that when he spun on his heel, he really did spin on his heel, performing several complete rotations before stopping with his back turned to Hackworth and storming away.
"Revolutionary, ain't it?" he snapped.
The thing in Hackworth's pocket was a pair of dark sunglasses, wraparounds with a glimmering rainbow finish, the sort of thing that, decades ago, would have been worn by a magnum-slinging rebel cop in a prematurely cancelled television series. Hackworth unfolded them and slid the polished ends of the bows cautiously over his temples. As the lenses approached, he could see light coming from them. They were phenomenoscopes, though in this context the word phantoscope might have been more appropriate. The image grew to fill his sight, but would not focus until he put them all the way on, so he reluctantly plummeted into the hallucination until it resolved, and just then the bows behind his ears came alive, stretched, and grew around the back of his skull like a rubber band snapping in reverse, joining in the back to form an unbreakable band.
"Release," Hackworth said, and then ran through a litany of other standard Yuvri commands.
The spectacles would not release his head. Finally, a cone of light pierced space from somewhere above and behind him and splashed across a stage. Footlights came up, and a man in a top hat emerged from behind a curtain.
"Welcome to your show," he said. "You can remove the glasses at any time by securing a standing ovation from not less than 90% of the audience."
Then the lights and curtain vanished, and Hackworth was left with what he had seen before, namely a cybernetically enhanced night-vision rendering of the deck of the ship. He tried a few more commands. Most phenomenoscopes had a transparent mode, or at least translucent, that allowed the wearer to view what was really there. But these ones were doggedly opaque, and would only show him a mediatronic rendering of the scene. The strolling and chatting theatergoers were represented by preposterously oversimplified wireframes, a display technology unused these 80 years or so, clearly intended to irritate Hackworth. Each figure had a large placard strapped to its chest, such as,
"Gerard Mason Griffin III, age 35.
Too late to become an interesting character like you.
Nephew of an Earl-level equity lord.
Don't you envy him?
Married to that sunken bitch on his right. They go on these little escapades to escape their own crippled lives. Why are you here?"
Hackworth looked down and tried to read the placard on his own chest, but couldn't focus on it. When he walked around the deck, his viewpoint changed correspondingly. There was also a standard interface that enabled him to fly around the ship. Hackworth himself remained in one fixed location, of course, but his viewpoint in the spectacles became unlinked to his real coordinates. Whenever he used this mode, the following legend was superimposed on his view in giant, flashing red block letters.
"John Percival Hackworth's Godlike Perspective."
Sometimes accompanied by a cartoon of a wizardly sort of fellow sitting atop a mountain, peering down into a village of squalid midgets. Because of this annoyance, Hackworth did not use this feature very frequently. But on his initial reconnaissance, he discovered a few items of interest. For one thing, the Nipponese fellow who had got pissed and fallen overboard had encountered a group of several other people who had, by a remarkable coincidence, also fallen out of their boats on the way here, and who, upon being rescued, had all begun to emit colored light and see visions that they insisted on recounting to anyone in the vicinity. These people convened into a poorly organized chorus, all shouting at once and articulating visions that seemed to be linked in an approximate way, as if they had all just now awakened from the same dream and were all doing an equally bad job describing it. They stuck together despite their differences, drawn together by the same mysterious attractive force that causes street corner crackpots to set up their soapboxes right next to each other. Shortly after Hackworth zoomed toward them in his phenomenoscopic view, they began to hallucinate something along the lines of a giant eyeball peering at them from the heavens, the black skin of its eyelids studded with stars. Hackworth skulked away and focused in on another large gathering, a couple of dozen older people of the trim, fit, and active style, tennis sweaters draped over their shoulders and sensible walking shoes firmly but not too tightly laced to their feet, piling off a small airship that had just moored on the old helicopter pad near the ship's stern. The airship had many windows and was festooned with mediatronic advertisements for aerial tours of London. As the tourists climbed off, they tended to stop in their tracks so that a severe bottleneck was forever forming. They had to be goaded into the outer darkness by their tour guide, a young actress dressed in a cheesy devil outfit, complete with flashing red horns and a trident.
"Is this Whitechapel?"
one of them said to the fog, speaking in an American accent. These people were obviously members of the Heartland tribe, a prosperous file closely allied with New Atlantis that had absorbed many responsible, sane, educated, white Midwestern middle-class types. Listening in on their furtive conversations, Hackworth divined that these tourists had been brought in from a Holiday Inn in Kensington, under the ruse that they were going to take the Jack the Ripper tour in Whitechapel. As Hackworth listened, the diabolical tour guide explained that their drunken airship pilot had accidentally flown them to a floating theater, and they were welcome to enjoy the show, which would be starting shortly, a free, to them, performance of Cats, the longest-running musical of all time, which most of them had already seen on their first night in London. Hackworth, still peering through the mocking red letters, did a quick scan below decks. There were a dozen cavernous compartments down there. Four of them had been consolidated into a capacious theater. Four more served as the stage and backstage. Hackworth located his daughter there. She was seated on a throne of light, rehearsing some lines. Apparently, she'd already been cast in a major role. "I don't want you to watch me like that," she said, and vanished from Hackworth's display in a burst of light. The ship's foghorn sounded. The sound continued to echo sporadically from other ships in the area. Hackworth returned to his natural view of the deck, just in time to see a blazing figment rushing toward him. The clown again, who apparently possessed the special power of moving through Hackworth's display like a phantasm.
"Going to stay up here all night, guessing the distance to the other ships by timing the echoes? Or may I show you to your seat?"
Hackworth decided that the best thing was not to be ruffled. "Please," he said.
"Well, there it is, then," said the clown, gesturing with one maculated glove toward a plain wooden chair right before them on the deck.
Hackworth did not believe it was really there because he hadn't seen it before now, but the spectacles allowed him no way to tell. He stepped forward like a man making his way to the toilet in a dark and unfamiliar room, knees bent, hands outstretched, moving his feet gingerly so as not to bark shins or toes on anything. The clown had drawn to one side and was watching him scornfully.
"Is this what you call getting into your role? Think you can get away with scientific rationalism all night? What's going to happen the first time you actually start believing what you see?"
Hackworth found his seat exactly where the display told him it would be. But it wasn't a simple wooden chair. It was foam-covered, and it had arms. It was like a seat in a theater. But when he groped to either side, he did not find any others. So he depressed the seat and fell into it.
"You'll be needing this,"
the clown said, and snapped a tubular object into the palm of Hackworth's hand. Hackworth was just recognizing it as some kind of torch when something loud and violent happened just below him. His feet, which had been resting on the deck plates, were now dangling in air. In fact, all of him was dangling. A trap door had flown open beneath him, and he was in free fall.
"Enjoy the show," the clown said, tipping his hat and peering down at him through a rapidly diminishing square hole. "And while you're accelerating toward the center of the Earth at 9.8 meters per second squared, riddle me this. We can fake sounds, we can fake images, we can even fake the wind blowing over your face, but how do we fake the sensation of free fall?"
Pseudopods had sprouted from the chair's foam and wrapped around Hackworth's waist and upper thighs. This was fortunate, as he had gone into a slow, backward spin and soon found himself falling face first, passing through great amorphous clouds of light. A collection of old chandeliers that Dramatis Personae had scavenged from condemned buildings. The clown was right. Hackworth was definitely in free fall, a sensation that could not be faked with spectacles. If his eyes and ears were to be believed, he was plunging toward the floor of the big theater he had reconnoitered earlier. But it was not grooved with neat rows of seats like an ordinary theater. The seats were present, but scattered about randomly, and some of them were moving. The floor continued to accelerate toward him until he got really scared and started to scream. Then he felt gravity again as some force began to slow him down. The chair spun around so that Hackworth was looking up into the irregular constellation of chandeliers, and the acceleration shot up to several G's, then back to normal. The chair rotated so that he was on the level once more, and the phenomenoscope went brilliant, blinding white. The earpieces were pumping white noise at him, but as it began to diminish, he realized it was actually the sound of applause. Hackworth was not able to see anything until he fiddled with the interface and got back to a more schematic view of the theater. Then he determined that the place was about half full of theatergoers, moving about independently on their chairs, which were somehow motorized, and that several dozen of them were aiming their torches toward him, which accounted for the blinding light. He was on center stage, the main attraction. He wondered if he was supposed to say something. A line was written across his spectacles. "Thanks very much, ladies and gentlemen, for letting me drop in. We have a great show for you tonight." Hackworth wondered if he was somehow obligated to read this line, but soon the torches turned away from him as more audience members began to rain down through the astral plane of the chandeliers. Watching them fall, Hackworth realized that he'd seen something like it before at amusement parks. This was nothing more than bungee jumping. It's just that the spectacles had declined to show Hackworth his own bungee cord, just to add an extra frisson to the whole experience. The armrest of Hackworth's chair included some controls that enabled him to move it around the floor of the house, which was cone-shaped, sloping sharply in toward the center. A pedestrian would have found difficult footing, but the chair had powerful nanotech motors and compensated for the slope. It was a round theater, globe-style. The conical floor was encompassed by a circular wall, pierced here and there by openings of different sizes. Some appeared to be ventilation shafts, some were the apertures of private boxes or technical control rooms, and by far the largest was a proscenium that occupied a quarter of the circumference and that was currently closed off by a curtain. Hackworth noted that the lowest and innermost part of the house floor was not occupied. He motored down the slope and was shocked to realize that he was suddenly up to his waist in painfully chilly water. He threw the chair into reverse, but it did not respond to the controls.
"Dead in the water!" cried the clown triumphantly, sounding as if he were standing right there, though Hackworth couldn't see him.
He found a way to release the chair's built-in restraints and struggled up the raked floor, his legs stiff from the cold and reeking of seawater. Evidently, the central third of the floor actually plunged beneath the waterline and was open to the sea, another fact that Hackworth's spectacles had not bothered to reveal. Again, dozens of lights were on him. The audience was laughing, and there was even some sarcastic applause. "Come on in, folks, the water's fine," suggested the spectacles. But once again, Hackworth declined to read the line. Apparently, these were nothing more than suggestions, tossed out by Dramatis Personae's writers, which faded from the display as they lost their currency. The events of the last few minutes,
The phenomenoscopes that couldn't be taken off, the unexpected bungee jump, the plunge into cold seawater, had left Hackworth in a state of shock. He felt a strong need to hole up somewhere and shake off the disorientation. He clambered up toward the perimeter of the house, dodging the occasional moving chair and tracked by a few spotlight beams from fellow audience members who had taken a particular interest in his personal story. An aperture was above him, glowing with warm light, and passing through it, Hackworth found himself in a cozy little bar with a curving window that afforded an excellent view of the theater. It was a refuge in more ways than one. He could see normally through the spectacles here. They seemed to be giving him an untampered view of reality. He ordered a pint of stout from the barman and took a seat at the counter along the window. Somewhere around his third or fourth gulp of stout, he realized that he had already submitted to the clown's imperative. The plunge into the water had taught him that he had no choice but to believe in what the spectacles showed his eyes and ears, even though he knew it to be false, and to accept the consequences. A pint of stout went some distance toward warming up his legs and toward relaxing his mind. He had come here for a show, and he was getting one, and there was no reason to fight it. Dramatis personae might have a dodgy reputation, but no one had ever accused them of killing a member of the audience. The chandeliers dimmed. The torch-wielding audience went into motion-like sparks, stirred by a gust of wind, some motoring toward the high ground and others preferring the water's edge. As the house lights faded to black, they amused themselves playing their torches back and forth across the walls and the curtain, creating an apocalyptic sky torn by hundreds of comets. A tongue of clammy, algae-colored light shone beneath the water, resolving itself into a long, narrow thrust stage as it rose toward the surface, like Atlantis resurgent. The audience noticed it and bounced their spotlights off the surface, catching a few dark motes in the crossfire. The heads of a dozen or so performers slowly rising out of the water. They began to speak in something like unison, and Hackworth realized that they were the chorus of lunatics he had seen earlier.
"Set me up, Nick," said a woman's voice behind him. "Tucked them in, did you?" said the barkeep. "Ninnies."
Hackworth turned and saw that it was the young woman in the devil costume who had acted as tour guide for the Heartlanders. She was very petite, dressed in a long black skirt slit all the way up to the hip bone, and she had nice hair, very thick and black and glossy. She carried a glass of wheat beer over to the counter, primly swept her devil's tail out of the way in a gesture that Hackworth found hopelessly fetching, and took a seat. Then she let out an explosive sigh and put her head down on her arms for a few moments, her blinking red horns reflecting in the curved window like the tail lights of a full laner. Hackworth laced his fingers together around his pint and smelled her perfume. Down below, the chorus had gotten out of hand and was trying to pull off a rather ambitious Busby Berkeley dance number. They showed an uncanny ability to act in unison, something to do with the sights that had burrowed into their brains, but their bodies were stiff, weak, and badly coordinated. What they did with absolute conviction, which made it good anyway.
"Did they buy it?"
Hackworth said.
"Pardon me?"
said the woman, looking up alertly like a bird, as if she hadn't known Hackworth was there.
"Do those Heartlanders really believe that story about the drunken pilot?"
"Oh, who cares?" the woman said. Hackworth laughed, pleased that a member of Dramatis Personae was affording him this confidence.
"It's off the point, isn't it?" the woman said, in a lower voice, getting a bit philosophical now. She squeezed a wedge of lemon into her wheat beer and took a sip. "Belief isn't a binary state, not here at least. Does anyone believe anything 100%? Do you believe everything you see through those goggles?"
"No," Hackworth said. "The only thing I believe at the moment is that my legs are wet, this stout is good, and I like your perfume."
She looked a bit surprised, not unpleasantly so, but she wasn't nearly that easy.
"So why are you here? Which show did you come to see?"
"What do you mean?" "I suppose I came to see this one."
"But there is no this one. It's a whole family of shows, interlaced."
She parked her beer and executed phase one of the "here is the church" maneuver.
"Which show you see depends on which feed you're viewing."
"I don't seem to have any control over what I see."
"Ah, then you're a performer."
Well, so far, I have felt like a very inept slapstick performer.
Inept slapstick? Isn't that a bit redundant?
It wasn't that funny, but she said it wittily and Hackworth chuckled politely.
It sounds as though you've been singled out to be a performer.
You don't say.
Now, I don't normally reveal our trade secrets, the woman continued in a lower voice, but usually when someone is singled out as a performer, it's because they have come here for some purpose other than pure passive entertainment.